So it's with great pleasure that I introduce John Pierre Wolfe.
Thank you. Well, with such an introduction, I need to be on my best behavior. I have requested to get a little sign when I'm 45 minutes in the presentation. There'll be also opportunity for questions because that's, you know, the part that keeps me on my toes. And the topic that we have here, I'm going to try to, you know, encapsulate it a little bit. Firstly, when we talk about sustainability, you know, we have three major types of agriculture practices, actually four. One is I would call standard old-fashioned agriculture practices. The second one is sustainable practice. The next one is organic. And the last one is biodynamic. The organic farming is very much pest and herbicide centric, using products which are certified. And so that's sort of a foundation of organic certifications, which is done through the California Department of Food and Agriculture. So it's a regulated certification. The biodynamic is also certified through the California Department of Food and Agriculture, and has similar elements to organic, except that in this particular case, you look more at, you know, natural cycles of the earth. For example, if you're going to be racking the wine, you do it on a full moon. You use the solstice as times of certain farming activity. Your compost, if it's animal compost, needs to be from animals raised on the property, etc. And then you have the sustainability movement, which is the one I'm going to be discussing a little bit. There are a lot of confusions and misuse of a term sustainability. You know, a little bit analogous to, you know, the green movement, where, you know, we do have some folks saying, well, you know, you have a green wash. You know, everything is now green. And you see, you know, probably you'll see sustainable credit cards one of these days. You know, I wouldn't be surprised. So in California, you know, the sustainability practices, Ground Zero started actually in the Central Valley with a sustainability program that was developed originally by Italian-Swiss farmers. And they brought from Switzerland, you know, some of their concepts of sustainability and certification. Then the vineyard team here in the Central Coast developed the SIP program, Sustainability in Practice, and I was on the original group that did the beta site. After we developed the practice, you know, we had to kick the tires, see how it was going to work, and so I was one of the volunteer sites, and then we tweaked it over time. You also now have the Wine Institute in collaboration with the California Wine Grape Growers Association having a certification program. And the certification programs are both for the vineyards and the winery. Well, I think that's a little bit confusing for the consumer because these are all self-certified program. You take the example of our neighbors in Oregon. Actually, in Oregon, it is administered through the Oregon Department of Food and Agriculture, because if you are certified organic or biodynamic or certified sustainable, which is the TILF program as they call it, or you have a fish-friendly certification, you qualify for what's called the green leaf logo, which goes in the back of a bottle. And that basically shows the consumer that your product is met the requirements in these categories. You know, there was an attempt done in California about 5 years ago to set up through the Department of Food and Agriculture a certification program, but it got derailed because it became politicized. So no surprise there. Now, when we talked, you talked about the Leonardo da Vinci. Well, there is the Leonardo Academy, which is a ANSI standard making body, ANSI, American National Standard Institute. And the Leonardo Academy is actually working right now on developing a sustainability certification program for food, for agriculture in the United States. It includes all ag commodities. So initially when the program was being developed, it almost imploded because if you take agriculturists in a room, it's like trying to train a herd of cats. And then if you're looking at, you know, Idaho potato growers and you mix them with rice growers, wine growers, cattlemen, it's not very harmonious. So smoke settled, dust settled, and now they have a first draft that just came out very recently. So you go online. This is not your homework for tonight, okay? You can do it, but by tomorrow I would like. Is you Google Leonardo Academy Agriculture Sustainability, and you will access the site. It's all transparent. Lot of good information. So that gets us to where this sustainability concept comes from. You know, and people ask me and say, well, you know, you have all these definitions, but what is the bottom line? I say, well, the bottom line is to allow your farming operation to be multi-generational and that the land that you farm will still be farmable in a half a century from now. That's the bottom line. But, you know, we need to tie this a little bit more neatly. So most of these sustainability programs revolve around a three-legged stool, the three E's. One of the E's is the environment. The second E is social equity. And the third E is economic sustainability. So when you look at all these certification programs that are being developed, they all have these same common elements. And they'll define them a little bit differently, but that's the basis. So I usually start with environment, socioeconomic, and then I move to economic. I'm gonna reverse it because I want the rest of our talk to be specifically addressing the environmental aspect. So first, economic sustainability. Well, you know, it's one thing to be a good steward of a land, but if you're not gonna be able to make a living at it, it's not gonna last for very long, and you're gonna succumb to developers. So when we're looking at the sustainability certification, how do we measure this? For example, one of them is, do you have an annual budget? What's your banker's relationship? Do you meet with your banker once a year at a minimum? Do you have crop insurance? And do you have a succession plan? So those are the different questions that are asked as part of the certification questionnaire. Sounds fundamental, but you know, you take some farming operations and you know, you just live on a year-by-year basis. So this helps you ground a little bit more. The second one relates to social equity. That ties to how do you treat your workers? Well, as mentioned, you know, I'm a family business, so I have my two sons working for me. There is an exclusion clause, my view, that social equity doesn't apply to my kids. So that's a, you know, they're excluded from that program. But there are tongue-in-cheek comment here. What it implies, for example, for my workers is what's the safety records? Do we have any safety violation? Do we have any complaints to the Ag Commissioner in regard to the farming activity, such as fugitive dust spraying when the wind speed exceeds 10 miles per hour and things like that? What's your relationship with the community? Do you organize tours, presentation? Are you engaged with your community? All those are actually questions as part of a social equity program. At the vineyard, for example, before the drought, I let my agriculture workers farm about a quarter of an acre for their own use, that it would irrigate, so they had corn and tomatoes and peppers, etc. So we transitioned last year to chickens. They asked me and say, "Oh, you know, could we have chickens, Mr. Wolf?" I said, "Sure, no problem." So now in the back of a property, we have what I call a Casa del Pollo, and we have, I think they have like 22 chickens, and you know, they divvy up in little cubicles which chickens belong to which worker, and so they have their own fresh farm eggs, and because where they live, they cannot have chickens. So, you know, that's all part of social equity and how you treat your workers. So then let's look at also the fundamentals that, you know, the old view of farming, which is, hey, this is my land, it's my God-given right to farm, and nobody's going to tell me what to do. I'm my own little island. You know, these concepts are not valid because it's interacted with, you know, your neighbors and the rest of the community where you work and where you live. So that's the other element, basically, fundamental elements in the social equity. So now let's move to the aspects, the E, relating to environmental sustainability. Environmental sustainability, we're looking at, one, the use of pesticides. And remember, when I say pesticide, it can mean organic, okay? Because I actually use a combination of organic, a little bit of biodynamic, and a little bit of sustainability. Now you're probably saying, this guy is totally schizophrenic. No, I do that because I believe in using best management practices. And you cannot take a nice three-ring binder with a set of checkpoints and say, if I do this, I'm in harmony with the environment. The environment is a lot more complex than that. So I like to kind of move around, and that's why actually I'm not certified organic, because I would find myself boxed in a little bit too much. But do remember that as an organic grower, you do use pesticide. It just happened to be organic certified, all right? For example, for powdery mildew, I use stylet oil, which is, you know, the base is canola oil. Well, I mean, if you can put canola oil on your salad, obviously, you know, it's, I wouldn't use the canola oil that I use because it's not refined for human consumption. But the idea is to use oil to smother the spores from powdery mildew. So it's an organic product. My fertilizer I use is seaweed. So it's a compost tea from seaweed, and it has been filtered, and we applied this systemically to the vines. And we do foliar treatment also to give them a little shot. You know, foliar treatment, you spray it on the leaves, and then it becomes absorbent very quickly. And then the systemic approach is putting the fertilizer in the drip irrigation, and it's called fertigation. Okay? All right. So we have the use of pesticides, herbicides, the use of what type of fertilizer you use. I mentioned my compost seaweed tea. I use also green compost and dairy farm compost from non-hormone source. And the reason I had done that is because I was concerned about the trace hormone residues in the compost, if the compost was not properly heat treated. Not that I was worried that, you know, the hormone will find himself in the wine. I mean, that would be a miracle, all right? As you go through all the process of fermentation, scientifically, no way. But, you know, if you put compost in the field, you know, you have all the little critters in the vineyard. And the little critters in the vineyard could inhale, take some of the compost, and then it goes into their chain. So that was one of the concerns that I had. So then we look at the aspect of wildlife habitat. So wildlife habitat, we have wildlife corridor, because if you look at wine grapes, you know, you could, in an extreme interpretation, say it's a big mono mega crop. That doesn't sound very good. So what you can do, however, is carve out areas that would be wildlife corridor to allow the wildlife in and outs. We use our riparian creek areas for that. And we also, in the center of the property, have a natural pond, which is for wildlife to, you know, be able to migrate to, particularly during the winter months, and also for various types of wildlife to be active. I saw an article in the Tribune last year, and I was very tempted to write a letter to the editor, and I didn't do it because my good common sense tells me don't do those things sometime, because then you go tit for tat. It was someone who said, you know, these big monomega crops, I mean, there's no wildlife, it's totally dead. And I'm like, how can you say that? Because I did correct that indirectly in my wine club newsletter. That was a sneaky way for me to do it, because I had a special newsletter where I talked about the wildlife in the vineyard. Well, we have bobcats, and we have weasels. We have golden eagles, white eagles, and red-tailed hawks, kestrel, and quails. A lot more quails than when I bought the property. And one time with a previous owner, I said, you know, boy, I sure have a lot of quails over the last 17 years that we own the vineyard. He said, oh, I used to love them. Six of them would fit perfectly in my pot. I'm like, well, no wonder, you know. So we do have quite a bit of wildlife, including deers. And 2 years ago, we had deers, you know, with beginning of a drought, coming by the house. And my wife says, honey, we have deers. We got to chase them out. They're going to eat the grapes. And I look at these deers, and these poor guys, you know, you could see they were starving. I mean, you could see the ribs. And I'm like, you know, they have a place here to let them eat a little bit of the grapes, and it's fine. I mean, it's not going to wipe out our crop. Now, maybe I'm a softie, but, you know, that's kind of part of how I tend to think. So those are for the critters that you can see. Now we have creeks, and one of them is a steelhead creek. Of course, it has not ran the last 4 years with a drought, but this is West Corral de Piedra. The steelhead comes from Pismo Beach, you know, through a little estuary, and then goes up Price Canyon, There's a fish ladder on 227 Price Canyon. And then it comes to West Corral de Piedra up to the Santa Lucia mountain range. So I've done quite a few projects for steelhead habitat improvements with resting pools, etc. So I can't wait for the creek to run again, so all that work over the years will work. But you know, steelheads have a good memory. They'll stay in the ocean, and when the creek opens up and is a live stream, they'll come back. So another part of the habitat is, of course, the aquatic habitat. And sometimes people say, why did you spend so much time and effort in all these creek restoration projects with dealing with Army Corps, Fisheries and Wildlife, NOAA, National Fisheries, etc.? Well, because it's all interconnected. It's part of a balance. You know, if you do have aquatic habitats thriving, it's an indicator of water quality. You know, yeah, I can take water sample, take it to a lab, but you know, the best proof is if you see population increasing and improving. Also taking care of your riparian corridor, preventing erosion. And earlier on, I spent quite a bit of time improving the riparian corridor because you know, in the old days, and still many properties like mine, the property line is center of a creek. That's how it's defined. So, if I can move the creek a little bit this way, I gain a couple of feet. And I do that every year, so that helps. So that was a practice in the old days, you know, and each party would say, oh, well, I'm gonna do the same thing. So then you end up with creeks looking like the LA River. And then also farmers do not like creeks that meander. We like straight lines. It's so much easier with a tractor. So we kind of tend to realign the creeks. And of course, when you realign a creek on a straight line, what happens to the water velocity? It increases. That's why Mother Nature has the sinusoidal configuration, and actually it is equation for that, because it slows down the water. And then if you play this game of pushing the edges, you cause erosion. What erosion does, it clogs the infiltration in the groundwater basin, right? And if you speed up the water velocity, you reduce the recharge time in the basin, and you cause what's called incising of a creek, where initially, and you'll find that around many of our creeks, in some areas, all of a sudden the creek bottom is 25 feet. In another place, it's 16. Well, as I explained to my neighbor, I said, you know, if we prevent incising, we're improving the groundwater recharge and storage. How's that? I say it's trapezoidal. You know, the higher the water table, the more capacity you have, because a water table is like a funnel, right? So if you incise very deep, and you, let's say, incise losing 10 feet, you lose 10 feet of aquifer static water potential. So I remember explaining that to some of my neighbors one time, and they're like, well, this guy is not as crazy after all, you know? He talks funny, and he's done some strange things, but it does make sense. So, you know, more and more we're on board doing that. So that's another part of a sustainability that's interconnected with water. The tiny little critters, insects, and microbes are also taken care of, because we have integrated pest management, which is using good bugs to fight bad bugs. For example, we have mealybugs, and mealybugs actually in large quantities can be irritant to the tissue of a vine, also can contaminate the clusters and give an off flavor to the wine if you have a lot of mealybugs in the clusters. And so these little guys hide in the wood of the vine, in the bark. So one of the techniques to reduce the population of mealybugs, and in my property they're called the obscure mealybugs, by the way. You have the long-tail mealybug, the vine mealybug, and the obscure, their main category. The obscure name was given at UC Berkeley, the entomology department, and ground zero of the trials was on my property. And I was very glad that they called it the obscure mealybug and not the wolf mealybug. So these are stealthy little guys. They usually are in coastal areas where it's moisture, a little cooler. You have less mealybug pressure inland where it gets warmer. So one of the techniques is a pruning technique to reduce the amount of old wood, because a cane doesn't have a place to hide. So you basically displace the habitat for the mealybug. Check, that's one technique. The other technique is to use pheromone mating disruptors. So you use pheromone cards, which have a scent of a female mealybug, and you strategically locate them where you have mealybug activity, and I'll explain to you how you know you have mealybug activity. And what happens is that then the male mealybug is attracted by this pheromone card, and you know, looks around and says, gee, I must be missing something here. I mean, I can smell they're out here somewhere. And then they forget to do their business and they miss the reproduction cycle. So it's a way to basically decline the population. So that's one of the technique. You also use pheromone traps. That's different. That's to attract and do an insect count. I'm one of the volunteer vineyard in the area for the Ag Commissioner's office, where we have traps for different type of insects, which are pheromone based to attract them. And that's to do insect count and make sure we don't have other insects which would be predatory to viticulture activities. Another technique that we use is, how do we know, and mealybugs have a sweet secretion called honeydew. And this sweet secretion, that is why, for example, when you see ants going up your roses or your citrus, trust me, they're not after your beautiful roses. You have aphis or you have scale, I guarantee you. The ants are going after this little honeydew secretion. Same thing with grapevines. So when you see ants going up and down the vine, you know you have mealybugs. The ants are the Argentinian ants. They're non-native. They came by ship, sailboats. So like most of the undesirable species that we have, including noxious weeds, okay, they came from Europe through settlers. So the Argentinian ant, they actually nurse the mealybug, carry them on their back, hide them between the bark, and try to have a nice healthy population of mealybugs so they have plenty supply of honeydew. Very creative little guys. So one of the technique that I had looked at was, there's a particular sweet grass that is an attractant to the ants, and I thought we'd put it in the center row between the vines. Well, you know, it's kind of hard to train an ant and say, stay in the middle, don't go to my vines. So that didn't work very well. So then we looked at commercializing ant traps. So initially, I was part of a program which was using various biotechniques for IPM. And one of the thought was to use the same compound in pet flea collars and dilute it by 100 times, because it was already safe for children, safe for pets. Well, it was going to take 5 years plus to get USDA approval, and couldn't find any interest amongst the pesticide manufacturers, you know, the big chemical companies. They didn't want to invest in the product, in the development. And, you know, I suspect possibly, shame on me to think that way, but, you know, there's money to be made in spray application. There's perhaps not as much money to make in selling ant traps. So we decided, let's try something ourselves. So I went back to my most favorite friend, boric acid. And so we used water, boric acid, and sugar, sugar to recreate about 30 bricks. That's milligrams of sugar per liter, okay? Same sweetness as the honeydew. So I had that in big jars, little contractions to put in the vineyard. And so we would look at areas where you had a lot of ant activity. And then initially, I had too much boric acid, so the ants would die before going back to the colony. The idea, you don't want to poison them and kill them. You want them to go to the colony, ideally kill the queen, and also do major damage to the nursery. So that didn't work. No, that's research. When you do research, you know, if you succeed every time, you're sandbagging, right? You're not trying hard enough. So then we throttled back the boric acid. Now the unintended consequence was that, you know, boric acid actually prevents initial fermentation, because around harvest time you have a native yeast on the grapes, and so the wild yeast would cause spontaneous fermentation. I was making cheap mead, you know, sugared water, yeast, and bingo. So the ants would go into my traps and then it would get drunk. Well, then they wouldn't find their way back to the colony. So that didn't work. So you ask yourself, how did he know this? Well, we were in our research project, we were using Cal Poly students, you know, for scouts to count the ants. And students will do anything for credit units, you know? So I had no problem. I had plenty supply of scouts. So we did the trials, and now we have it figured out, and the product is commercialized, and one of the brand name, by the way, is called Gourbet, and you can use it for vineyard. And that's then a substitute from using pesticides. Well, it is a pesticide in a way, but you know, you don't spray it. So we collapse the ant population, which reduced then the increase of mealybug population. So that's another good example. So let's now move to water. This guy. And as you notice, water is making big headline in the paper. And you know, there's other aspects that I will skip because of the time. Soil management, microbial activity in the ground, cover crop. I use, by the way, the Yalman plow, which is an implement designed in Australia for carbon sequestration, because it's not a plow, it's not the disc, and it doesn't deep rip. It cracks open the ground, so it maintains the carbon in the soil. We're finding increasing value in carbon. One, because plants need carbon. Two, it improves infiltration. If you have carbon-rich soil, you have a lot more permeability of the soil. And then, of course, from a greenhouse gas emission, it also can store carbon. And there's potential trials looked at currently using carbon, you know, cap and trade in agriculture production that can show high carbon content. And this is now one element that you have to measure as part of certification, is taking carbon soil sample. So, water. How much water does it take to produce 1 gallon of wine? And I know questions are for later, but this is the one where I put you on the spot.
70 gallons.
70 gallons. 100. 500 gallons? 20 gallons? All right, this is like an auction. I like it. So, 8 gallons.
What?
8 gallons. That includes the irrigation water and the water in the winery to process the wine. Okay, about 8. And how many gallons of water does it take to produce 1 gallon of beer? Because my friend here is saying, oh, I want to help the environment, so maybe I should switch to beer. You know?
40.
40, yes. Yes, yes, it's 40. Now, you know, I give you ranges because some of you may go on your smartphone and double check me and you say, you know, this other site says it's 50. Beer is a lot more simply because when you use hop grain, you have to rehydrate it, right? So all the liquid in there is basically water, whereas with wine grapes, it's the juice. Two, with beer making, the sanitary requirements are a lot more stricter, so you have much more water wash activities. One of the biggest brewery consortium in the world, Interbrew, they're the one who owns Stella Artois, they're the one who owns Budweiser now. Their corporate goal worldwide is within 5 years to reduce their water use by 20%. It's a big deal because in many countries, water is very expensive, okay? So looking then at water in vineyards, one of the techniques is drip irrigation. Drip irrigation, a lot more effective. Currently, there are a lot of trials for subsurface drip irrigation. The drip irrigation technology came from Israel. Okay, I've gone to Israel many times on business, and you go to the kibbutz areas, you know, they learn how to do a lot more with less in the desert. So right now there are new technologies using subsurface drip irrigation, and we're getting over the problem of animals chewing on the hoses, the emitters clogging up, etc., with different compounds and technologies. We're using techniques such as soil moisture sensors. For example, I have at the high elevation soil moisture sensors, 1 foot, 2 feet, 3 feet, at the midpoint on the property and the lower. Download it with a laptop computer. Oh, I could be, you know, wireless, but I like to walk, so, you know, go and download the information. So that's another technique. You actually have a new technique developed, which is in citrus, where you actually have moisture probes embedded, transducer embedded in the wood of the vine. You make an incision and you put this linear transducer in, close it in, and it actually monitors real time the moisture in the vine. We have other technique we're using today, which are, it's called the pressure bomb. It's a misnomer, nothing blows up. It's a vacuum chamber, okay? And you take a leaf and you basically, in a vacuum, suck the moisture contained in the leaf, and that's an indicator of how much moisture is contained. So that's another technique that's being used. We use increasingly localized weather stations for ET, evapotranspiration. Two big components in water use. Evaporation is with the sun and with the wind, how much water evaporates from the ground. And then you have the transpiration of a vine. When it's hot, a vine transpires. The same as we do. Why do we transpire when it's hot? To keep cool, right? Thermodynamics. So same thing with a vine. When you have lots of wind, there is a loss of moisture of a transpiration of a vine. Also, when the leaf moves, it takes energy. You know, a vine is a living thing, so it also consumes water. If we take 100% ET, that means you would irrigate to replenish 100% of evaporation loss and transpiration loss. So typically, we use water deficit irrigation, meaning we irrigate less than the 100%, you know, 80%, 75%. In my case, right now, I am at less than 60. I'm kind of extreme irrigation, and in fact, some of my old vine Chardonnay is dry farmed. I called it extreme dry because, you know, they haven't seen water for 4 years. So that's another methodology to reduce water use. There is a relationship too between water use and crop production. If you're going to have heavy, large commercial grade crop, you know, for wine that you put on the market at, say, you know, the $5 a bottle, you're going to have to produce more than 4 tons to the acre. You know, you're going to have to be in the, you know, 8, 10 plus tons to the acre. That means more water. What we're looking at too is some of the aspects of irrigation practice or frost protection. Where I'm at in the Etna Valley, we use windmills to take the warm air strata that is above, bring it down, and then move it around the vineyard floor. So that's the principle in using windmills. So, you know, we're looking more and more at how can we be a little smarter. And one of the technique is also being judicious about the rootstock. A lot of effort currently done in California universities to develop drought-resistant rootstock. The ones I use is 1103P, as in Paul, and those also have high salt tolerance. One of the problem with lack of water quantity is the salt buildup in the ground, because you don't leach out the salt. So developing more drought-tolerant plants and also salt-tolerant is a win-win. Some of the far-out studies being done right now in research is to look at some of the genes of plants that do have good drought tolerance. Which plant has great drought tolerance? Cacti. So we're looking at what makes a cacti still thrive in the desert. Well, at nighttime, you have a lot of dew in the desert, right? So the cacti open its pores and basically takes in water at nighttime. And then as soon as the sun comes up, it shuts the pores and it keeps the moisture inside. So the transpiration rate, you know, has basically a one-way valve between daytime and nighttime. So some of the research is to take that component and seeing how it could be applied, for example, to rootstocks. So you would end up with a vine that would use less water because you would reduce the transpiration. So, you know, this, you may think, gee, that's Frankenstein wine, but how is it going to taste? So that's where a lot of research is being done, you know, as the, you know, wine is all about flavors and taste ultimately. So, you know, you have that balance, indeed. We have also done a trial last year with a supplement to our irrigation water, which is a surfactant that changes the surface tension of water. When the water goes in the ground, it allows the roots to have more accessibility to that water. Okay? You may think water is water, but not exactly. So we've done trial with and without, and it's actually quite promising. I have pictures of it. The rows where we used this was markably, the canopy was healthier than where we didn't have these supplements. So there are all kinds of techniques being considered. You know, there's no silver bullet. It's all a little here, a little there, a little there. But clearly, you know, water is becoming, you know, a very precious commodity. And we need to be aware and realizing that it's, you know, it's finite, and it's our responsibility to do a better job in doing more with less, or the same with less. In the winemaking, same, you know, reducing the amount of water use. Until say 5 years ago, in wineries, you would backwash tanks and get rid of the water, gray water. Today, you don't do that. You reuse that water for other application. Instead of using a lot of water to wash the floors, power washers, using ozonation, steam cleaning. So a lot of techniques being increased to reduce water consumption. And the large commercial wineries actually are well aware of that and looking at ways to significantly reduce their water use. I'm involved with Cal Poly, and one of the big grape growers and wineries in California makes a wine that is sold at Trader Joe. You may have heard the name, $2, Chuck, right? And so, you know, one of the two brothers is sitting next to me, and we had a presentation on bioengineering and, you know, this concept of using cacti genes, etc. And at my table, said, gee, Jean-Pierre, said, you know, we could save thousands and thousands of dollars in water. This is absolutely fantastic. The fellow next to me said, yeah, because now you could make $1, Chuck. So, so it took it well. So I will now open to questions. And hopefully, you know, I kind of gave you a big broad stroke, you know, 20,000 foot elevation, and we drilled a little bit. But as discussed earlier, you know, when we talk about sustainability, it's all interconnected, and you can't assume because you're moving one part that you're not going to have an impact on another part. But so I'm open to questions. Yes, sir.
So with like water being a huge commodity these days, desalination plants being built in California. Can that water be used for agriculture, or do plants not like that?
Okay, I love that question because, you know, I could have planted that question because item I need to share is, yeah, good point. One is part of full disclosure, you know, I'm chairman of the Regional Water Quality Control Board here for the state of California. And so I probably know more than I should about water, and this is certainly a very big topic. So the question was, with the use of recycled water, desalinization, etc., can that water be used for agriculture? Okay, first, right now everybody is rushing toward desal, and the cost of desalinization threshold is such that it is very costly water for agriculture use. Some countries do that though, but in the US with the price of food, that would be quite a challenge. The big problem with challenge, I should rephrase, with desal is the energy use. It takes a lot of energy. Improvements are incrementally the membranes for the RO system, reverse osmosis system, where, you know, the rejection rate used to be 50-50. So for 100 gallon, you would take 100 gallon of seawater, you produce 50 gallon of drinking water, and 50 gallon of rejection water, which is the brine. Now we're being able to shave that to, you know, 55, in some case close to 60% of drinking water. Sandia Livermore Lab is working on the new cross-flow technology that is going to further improve by 15% the efficiency. It's still at a lab stage, so it's not commercialized. The other way of looking at recycled water is water treatment plants. Okay, I'll give you several examples. You take the city of Pismo Beach. The daily discharge in the ocean from their effluent is 1.1 million gallon, goes into the ocean. You take the city of San Luis Obispo, they're required by permit to discharge 1.2 million in San Luis Creek for aquatic habitat. And then the rest, which is in about another two and a half to 3 million gallon, is mostly in the creek and some settling ponds because there's no place to use it. So recycling these water is now being viewed as a precious commodity. We do have state regulation about agriculture water. It's called Title 22. I won't bore you with the detail, but we have total maximum daily loads that are allowed in that water. A lot of recycled water, though, does contain salt. And salt doesn't always do very well in agriculture, particularly with some of the row crops, such as leafy greens. They're very susceptible to salt. So what you have to do is to remove the salts from the water. It's totally doable. But it's another level of recycling that water. The other part too is that recycled water contains nitrates, and so sometimes you don't want to increase nitrate discharge in surface water because then it will impact groundwater quality ultimately. But take recycled water from a water treatment plant, say tertiary treated, now run it through reverse osmosis, what do you get? You get about 90 to 95% efficiency. So you will end up with about, out of 100 gallon, 90 gallon plus of drinking water and 10 gallons of brine and other compounds. So it's a lot more energy efficient. So more and more communities are looking at recycled water also for drinking water purpose. Last year in June, the legislators passed new rules allowing what's called direct groundwater recharge. The recycled water has to be at a certain quality level. You have wells in the ground and you re-inject the water in the aquifer, and you need at least 60 days of migration of that water before it would be used for drinking water. Why 60 days? That's our safety valve in case you had a whoops, okay? And we put a radioisotope tracer, and then you can actually figure out how old the water is, okay? We can do water aging, okay? We do that. That's how we know in California, some of the aquifers, we're pumping water that is 80 years old. Well, that means it's gonna take 80 years before it replenish. So you're depleting your bank account pretty darn quickly. Okay, so that's that answer. Yes?
When new wine vines are planted, how many years does it take for them to produce grapes that are used
yep.
for making
wine? We call it third leaf, 3 years. Okay. It's actually four because when you buy the vine, you can buy them in green pot, little pots, or bare roots. But they're already a year old. So you plant them, and then it takes 3 years before you have your first crop. Usually, when we plant, we're looking at a 20-25 year horizon in the investment, so, you know, before you would replant the vineyard. So I like to tell you know, some of the university business schools that when they teach strategic planning, you know, and we get excited with a 5-year strategic plan. Oh my God, you know, we're good. They say, talk to agriculturists, because when you plant grapes, you have a 20-year, 25-year horizon. Yes?
I was going to ask a question about economic sustainability. I'm wondering if there's, what's the relationship between size and economic stability? Is it always, sustainability rather, is it always better to be larger? Is there a particular size that seems to be more sustainable in vineyards? How does that work?
Okay, so the question is, what's the relationship in sustainability in viticulture between the size of a property? There was an article written 3 years ago, I think it's 3 years ago, in Wine Spectator, and the editorial article was The Cost of Dirt. And so it was very interesting because it had the cost per acre in California, you know, in Napa Valley, Paso Robles, Santa Barbara, et cetera, et cetera, East Coast, upstate New York, and on, Oregon, Washington, and then comparing with Europe, you know, in France, Chile, South Africa. It was obviously all over the place. So when you go to our friends in Northern California, let's say Napa, and you buy a nice bottle of wine, you know, $75, right? You know, you're not gonna find anything in the $20 range, but how much do you pay for the land? It's gonna be, well, depending where, so I'm gonna give you just a ballpark figure. Some vineyards will go for $150,000 an acre, easy, you know, planted, okay. So is that sustainable? No, because even at $75, you have to have some means of paying for that. So there is an economy of scale, but it's also tied to the cost of the land. One point, though, with wine production is that it is incremental. I'll give you a quick little example. You know, you decide that you're gonna be a winemaker and fulfill your life dream of start making wine. So first year, you know, you rent your little corner somewhere in a custom crush facility, and you buy fruit from somebody you know, and you make 3 barrels. And I'm like, boy, this is great. And you sell out just like that because all your friends and your family feel sorry for you, you know? So it's like, you know, man, I'm sold out. So I'm like, I'm gonna go for 10 barrels. So that still kind of work. But eventually, you're gonna have to sell wine to people you don't know, right? So that becomes a bit of a challenge. Then we have the economy of scale associated with the facilities. A facility that produces 5,000 cases, can you do 10,000? Pretty much. If I go from 10,000, should I go to 15? Probably not. You may want to go to 20. Why? Because above 10,000 triggers other regulatory permits. For example, you no longer have from the Regional Water Board a small winery waiver. You're going to have a recycled system, holding ponds, treatment of the water, et cetera, of your gray water system. So cost goes up. So we're looking at, and many processing industries are like that, so you're looking at step functions. So it's not, you know, a nice, smooth increase. The article, and I thought that was a strong comment, basically said in California, if your vineyard is less than, at the time, 60 acres, you're a hobbyist. That was a strong statement. If you really want to make a living at it, and there's a big difference selling fruit and also selling wine. In my case, I do both. I'm a grower, I sell fruit by the ton, and I sell fruit by the 2 pound, but they're fermented, okay? And I get a little more money for these guys, but if you take my 2012 Pinot, okay, we're in 2015, all right? So I paid for all the growing cost in 2012, and the making of a wine, and then I barreled it for a whole year in French oak, and then I bottled the following year. So I've been sitting on inventory for all this time. But like Orson Welles used to say, you know, you shall drink no wine before its time. So that's fine, you know. It makes it for a lovely wine, but there is an investment cost. So ultimately, if you do have a right economic balance, you know, if you're a grower, you get paid at the end of the year. One check per customer, right? And then if you built the financial ability to ride through inventory cost, then you have the other cycle of a wine. So this balance works pretty well. Other question? Yes. 125. Yeah, I have 125, so it's definitely not a hobby. And you know, I do sometimes come to the tasting room, and on weekends say hi to people, and you know, folks will look at my prematurely white hair. I only do this to show signs of maturity, and then they'll say, "Oh, this gotta be such a nice retirement." And then here I'm schlepping wine, you know? I'm like, I told a person one time, I said, "Hey, if this was a hobby, you think I'd be working today?" But we talked about this earlier. You know, one of you said, "Well, you know, Jean-Pierre, it's kind of a unique industry because the people who are in the wine industry have a passion." And that is correct. You know, you have to have a passion. Because one, you have to have a pretty good level head, you know, in terms of being able to still make the right decision scientifically and in the winemaking, and also a good business sense. But you have to have also the creative and artistic side. Wine is not made in a lab, all right? Yeah, you take lab information around harvest, and I do Brix measurement and TA and pH, and I do what's called berry sensory maturity evaluation, etc. Ultimately, I pick berries along the rows, put them in my mouth, taste it, and I'll take the skin and kind of mix it in my hand, and if it's very slimy, the berry is not ripe. If the skin breaks, the berry is ripe. Then I take the stem. If I pull the stem and some of the meat comes out, the berry is not ripe. If it slides out, the berry is ripe. And then I take the seed and I look. If the seeds are green, forget it. And if they're brown, depending on the variety, I'll say yes. If they're black, I'm quite there. And then I'll take the seed and I chew on it. If it has a very bitter, astringent taste, not ready. If it has more of a coffee bean kind of taste, the berry is ready. I didn't come up with these. You know, this was actually a study done in France and Australia. Developing some of these little techniques, because your most important instrument is this one. Okay, so that's basically how I know when I'm good to go. Yes, sir, and then Ms.
So how do you take that sample? vineyard to know that.
Okay, the question is, how do I take these samples? Well, for one thing, we do have sentinel vines where year after year I take samples and then take it to the lab, and then we do sugar count, total acidity, pH. But when I do my little sampling, the tricky part is not to bias myself, because I'm a little bit like a bird, you know. I get attracted by the bigger berries. And that's the wrong thing to do. So you gotta really take the sample. So what I'll do is I'll take a berry from the bottom of a cluster, from the side and the top, you know, and I kind of go quickly at it and move along and do a few rows, and then I get a pretty good feel where things should be. So that's the technique. And you know, years ago, where I have grape contracts, you know, if a winemaker would come, say, "Ah, oh, I gotta come and check things out." I say, "Sure, come on," and we would do it too. And now after these years, say, "Jean-Pierre, whenever you tell me it's ready, I'm good with it. I don't even need to come and look at your place." So, you know, we built the relationship of the trust. And being myself a winemaker, it's like, I mean, I'm not gonna cut corner. I'm not gonna pick before ripeness. Which reminds me one quick point, climate change. And that's gonna be a game changer also in agriculture. Not just water availability, but temperature. You know, there are maps looking at the incremental temperature change. I mean, you read the paper, you watch the news. Right now, we've been breaking every single record in terms of temperature. My vines are 5 weeks over the average of the last 17 years. I probably will harvest end of July, beginning of August. Past years, September, you know? So this year, who knows, end of August, I may be in Puerto Vallarta, you know, drinking margaritas, and I'm done. So areas where we had cab may no longer be suitable for cab. Areas where Pinot was the best location may have to migrate to other varieties. I'm not trying to scare anyone, but you know, these are scientific studies done by and peer reviewed, and we do have actually maps looking at some of the change. Some of the change is the wind pattern. That impacts the vines. The fog. We have a lot less coastal fog where I'm at. And I rely on the fog to rehydrate my vines at nighttime, particularly the years that I dry farm. Which, you know, dry farming only works when it rains, right? I'm interviewed by a radio station tomorrow on my dry farming. I feel sorry for the reporter because I say, you know, it's not really working well right now. The first 2 years, that was fine. Third year was fine, but I love this recent rain we got. But you know, you look at the winter rehydration in order to make it through the summer months. The vine looks healthy, so maybe I'm contradicting myself. But you know, I'm certainly I will have a lower crop than an average year. Yes. Yeah, the question is, do other agriculturists, you know, increasingly also look at better ways of saving water? You know, the answer is yes, and it's been a big wake-up call. One of them is going to be because of the regulatory pressures. You know, last year, 2014, was the 100th anniversary of the California water rights, which are called pre-1914 senior rights. So we're operating in a 100-year-old system. Last year, we were the only state in the nation that did not have any groundwater regulation, none. So you know, this was a big milestone this year when the governor's office set up these sustainable groundwater basin management act. Basin considered high priority, that's Paso Robles in terms of depletion, and medium priorities, Edna Valley and Nipomo, although Nipomo is an adjudication and Los Sosos also, by 2017 have to have a groundwater management plan. And then by 2020, groundwater management implementation and an agency by 2017. So this is throughout California. So you're going to find increasing pressure in order to address proper use of water. And the problem, you know, the Central Coast, 80% of the water used is from groundwater. We hardly in the Central Coast have any aqueduct water. The Central Valley relied on the water canals and irrigation canals. And so because their allocation has been cut, you know, down to 12 and 15%, they rely more on groundwater, which now we're depleting the groundwater aquifer, and that's why in the Central Valley we have subsidence. The ground is dropping. And in some places the ground has dropped 18 feet, okay? Once it drops, you lose aquifer capacity and it's irreversible. I mean, you don't change it. It's not gonna go back up again. That's why we have some of the canals in the Central Valley, and I have pictures of it, where the concrete is buckling. And, you know, water doesn't go uphill. So you basically have a depression, like a big bathtub. So the water goes down, but then it doesn't flow correctly anymore. So we have some major civil engineering projects to try to address this right now. So I don't want to abuse any more of your patience. I brought also business cards that I'll put it over here. And it has my email and phone number. And if I can be of any further help in clarifying my presentation, you know, I'm an email away, and I want to thank you very, very much. That was an honor to speak to all of you. And I'm going to turn over the mic now to
me, but to I you. Think we need to
thank you very much.